Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. This week we conclude our two-part series on the American West. Last week we looked at Western images and advertising. Today we explore how the West has been represented in the movies with Richard Etelaine. And after that, Eric Rauchway compares the efforts of President George Bush to restore confidence in American capitalism to Theodore Roosevelt's crusade against business corruption a century ago. But before we get to those subjects, Joey Skidmore takes a look at an important event that occurred this week in history.
On September 23, 1780, British spy John André was captured. He carried on his person papers which revealed Benedict Arnold's plans to surrender West Point to the British. Earlier in the American Revolution, Arnold had become a military hero, distinguishing himself in a number of engagements with the British. His finest moment may have been the decisive role he played in the American victory at Saratoga, which was the turning point in the war. But things turned sour for Arnold. He was passed over, initially, for promotion to a major generalship, and after being appointed commander of Philadelphia, he was court-martialed because of his disputes with civil authorities. Arnold was cleared of most of the charges brought against him, but reprimanded by Washington for the rest. He married Peggy Shippen, whose family had loyalist sympathies, and when assigned to West Point began making arrangements to betray the American stronghold to the British in exchange for a British commission and money. The plot was discovered with the capture of John André, who was subsequently executed, but Arnold escaped. In 1781, in the British service, Arnold led raids on the coasts of Virginia and Connecticut before retiring to England and Canada, where he was generally scorned and unrewarded.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, archaeologists exploring the banks of the Indian River in Jensen Beach, Florida, have discovered an important ancient Indian site. Named Mount Elizabeth, the giant prehistoric Indian mound, called a midden, is believed to be at least 4,000 years old. It is nearly 35 feet tall, and it covers an area about the size of a football field. Archaeologists working the site believe that Mount Elizabeth was once about 60 feet tall, and that it was a combination of a burial and ceremonial site. Some of the artifacts removed from the mound are undergoing radiocarbon dating to determine their age more precisely. "It's all a mystery," one archaeologist commented. "This mound is one of our only chances to learn about these Indians, about whom very little has been written." This is Talking History.
It's just my pony and I'll saddle up a mare. We're pleased to have with us this week Dick Edelang, Director Emeritus of the Center of the American West at the University of New Mexico. Dick is the co-editor of The Hollywood West, just published by Fulcrum Publishing, and was in Omaha recently to lecture at the Joslin Art Museum on the subject, The Magic West on Film. Welcome, Dick. Why The Magic West is the title for your talk?
Some people like to use the word myth, and I find that that's a difficult word for most people. So I'm using the word magic as an idea that it's the imagined West, the West that you'd like to have it to have been, that we see in most Western films.
And that might not be mythic, or would it be the same?
Well, I use myth as not necessarily the opposite of truth, but a kind of memorialized West. And in this case, that lone hero riding, usually cowboy, across the wide landscape. And that was the idea that entered into the Western film early in the 20th century.
What was the first Western film in America?
Most people say the Great Train Robbery in 1903. There were little short items in the 1890s. That was 10 minutes long. It was made in the wilds of New Jersey. And it's intriguing to see it because there are about 13 segments in that 10-minute film. And it was made at the time when Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid were still holding up banks. So for many people, it seemed to be realistic and historical because it was something that was happening at that time.
And its focus, as the title suggests, is on a great train robbery.
Right, and that's why it's different from an awful lot of Westerns, because it's not a cowboy hero. It's set with a train robbery in New Jersey, the Lackawanna Railroad, and 10 minutes long. But it does end up out in the woods, that is, the eastern woods. So it does at least have an open setting, but it's not a cowboy kind of Western.
Well, let me pursue that for a minute. This may have been the first Western film, but the Western was not new, because we had popular novels and even Wild West shows. Did the director, and you may tell us who the director was in a moment, simply build on the images or, as you're suggesting, set off in new directions?
Certainly he did, and when you think about it, that new Western was a combination of two things. Technology, you had stiff-necked cameras that couldn't pan, so he was having to learn how to use the camera. This was Edwin S. Porter. Porter had, in fact, worked with several kinds of companies, but this was a first major film for him. So first, the technology. Secondly, he did build on the mythology, the ideas of the West, all the way from, and I would say that probably Buffalo Bill's Wild West, starting in 1883, was probably the most popular system of ideas about the West. But remember, The Virginian was published the year before, in 1902. So there was this popular ideology about what the West was. It's out there, where people don't know much about it, but it allows for the landscape of the single white male hero marching across the landscape. That's why The Great Train Robbery was different from that, but it built on the idea of heroic people doing right, setting wrongs right.
How does the idea of the heroic image come into a train robbery film?
Well, in this case, when you think about the difference of, say, what the James Brothers had become in the last part of the 19th century, they could be good, bad guys. And so often the early hero in the Western was a bad man who becomes good, a Robin Hood kind of hero.
Okay, so the film, the Western film has been around for a century now, and yet it has evolved, it has changed over the years. Each decade, like most popular culture, it changes to reflect the needs and desires and wishes of the population. Take us through the various time periods, perhaps beginning with the 1920s and 30s, and tell us how sort of the real-life events of the time influenced the films that were made. Let's start with the 20s and 30s.
Okay, the 1920s are a transitional period because what you're finding is the end of the careers of the first three major heroes, Bronco Billy Anderson, William S. Hart, and Tom Mix, are coming toward the end of their careers. And they had been the marquee heroes of the Western, the silent Western. And remember, the 1928-29 were moving to sound. So that means that all of the dramatics of those one or two reelers, 10 minutes or 20 minutes, are coming to an end. Coming online are the epics, and the epics are very patriotic, like The Covered Wagon and The Iron Horse, and those can be up to 60 minutes. And those are happening in the 1920s. So toward the end of the 1920s, you have the end of those cowboy heroes, the silents, some of the epics, and then coming online in 1929 are Gary Cooper and John Wayne. And they will take us into the 1930s.
So we actually have the technique to tell a story, a much more dramatic story, and even to add sound and so on. But did the nature of those stories change, perhaps in response to the Great Depression, for example?
Certainly did. And what you find in the late 1920s, early 1930s, was escape westerns. And I refer to them as series westerns, not necessarily serious westerns, because the singing cowboy comes online. And that happens a good deal in the early 1930s, and eventually we'll have Roy Rogers and Gene Autry. I would say that the film at the end of the 1930s, Stagecoach, 1939, gives you a wonderful illustration, at least from John Ford's perspective. And remember, he was a Democrat, and so he disagreed with an awful lot of Republican ideology. So the good guys in Stagecoach are the people that confound sort of Republican ideology, that the corporation, the banker people, are the good guys. They're not. It's the people that attack that are contesting that become the heroes in John Wayne's westerns.
All right, so this is more than just escapism. I was just reading an article yesterday about, for example, how today in the wake of 9/11, we look at things like Tolkien's Lord of the Rings and the Harry Potter books as pure escapism. This is an opportunity on film to present an image that people suffering from the Depression can actually grasp to get them through the difficulty.
Yes, and if you consider, as I do, Grapes of Wrath a western, then at the end of the 1930s, early part of the 1940s, you see that very much the social message of John Steinbeck and then the Henry Fonda film. And very much you see there the comment on the Depression and the Okies and the difficulty of that.
You describe it as a Western. That's interesting. Because it's set in the West?
I think so, and deals with modern Western themes. And so often people's image is it's a cowboy or it's not a Western.
Okay, take us to the post-World War II period. We need to move along. We're looking at the 50s, the Cold War. What do we see there on film?
Many people read High Noon, 1952-53, as a comment on the difficulties of the good man, in this case the Gary Cooper, being the good man, and the failure of the community to stand up to him. And so some people read that as the failure to stand up to McCarthy. I think it's difficult to read Shane, 1953, or The Searchers, 1956, as that kind of comment. There you find an interesting comment about the old cowboy hero has become a gunslinger in Shane. So you have comments on violence. Or in 1956, you have John Wayne playing this man who's so anti-Indian, and you find some comment about ethnicity and race rather than the comment on, say, McCarthyism.
What's the attraction to a gunfighter, a gunslinger coming in the 50s?
What happens is you put a gun in the hands of the hero, and he becomes a person who can use violence. It can be a regeneration through violence, as one scholar calls it, or it can be a disaster. It can be a negative kind of experience. Shane is a bringer of justice. And therefore, he is a man who uses a gun to bring justice.
But he does it outside the law, and he does it alone.
He does it alone, that's right. And some people refer to him as a kind of Christ figure at the end. You see, he's been wounded, and he goes out, but he's brought a kind of social justice to the valley.
Now, we've been talking about the influence of technology and perhaps other media. Television becomes a major factor during the 50s with shows that will come in like Gunsmoke and Ponderosa. Does this affect the films that were made of the West?
It does, and most people say it ends the B-Western. By B-Western, we mean low-budget Westerns. And it also introduces the kind of family concept, because you have a series and you can develop the minor characters, so that you have in Dodge City the development of those kinds of characters. Or in Bonanza, you can develop a series of characters, and you weren't able to do that in single Westerns. So what they provide is the possibility of ongoing family stories.
Do you have a particular favorite of television westerns?
Well, I like both of those two I just mentioned, but I also like to have Gun Will Travel, and I remember as a college student watching Cheyenne a great deal.
Interesting contrast, because I know they aired it, you know, roughly when you look at the same time, you look at Have Gun Will Travel and Gunsmoke, for example. I mean, they're very different images, the hired gun versus the marshal. Is this intended? Do you see this as sort of typical of the era to have these different images?
I think what you really could say is the 1950s was an Eden for the Western, and there was a variety of everything. Remember that famous image of Eisenhower recovering from his heart attack, and there he is lying in the bed in Denver reading Westerns. Mm-hmm. It was a wonderful time for people doing magic sort of images of the West.
Now, we move into the 60s, and you mentioned earlier, for example, the idea of race in Native Americans. We also have the influence of the Vietnam War. What impact do these forces have on Westerns?
I always use the dates 1968, 69, 70, and 71 is the turning point in the Western. And I suggest that Cat Ballou in 1964 with Jane Fonda as that kind of serial comic figure suggests the Western is changing. Whenever you can make fun or play fun with a genre type, it means that things are changing. So when you get to Little Big Man and you see what's happening there, and when you have a 5'8" Brooklyn Jew as sort of the hero, you know the Western is changing. And of course, Custer is a raving idiot in that film. And he's changed to the anti-hero. And in Butch Cassidy's Sundance Kid, they have raindrops falling on their head, but then there can be those extremely violent images and in that film and in The Wild Bunch.
Was the humor intended to take the edge off what was clearly criticism of Western behavior, American behavior in the West?
I think so. And when you have had those films from 68 to 71 that we just mentioned, and you find that the Vietnam War is over, and you try to put the Western back together again, how are you going to do it? Sometimes with humor. Blazing Saddles was an immensely popular Western, and you bring the black hero at the center. And what you do is you laugh at the genre. You can make fun of it. Or you can use music, as you did in Barbarossa with Willie Nelson. Mm-hmm. And those are attempts to put Humpty Dumpty back together again. And it was difficult in the 70s and 80s.
It was difficult. And the Western that was really a staple of American popular culture for decades begins to slide in the 70s. Was it because there was no way to deal with it any longer, given the mindset of Americans?
I think so. I think when you think post-Vietnam days, it's difficult to deal with the question of violence. People don't know what to do with it. And the Western was a film that deals with violence. And for a while, that disappeared. And then to reemerge in the late 80s and 90s with new kinds of Westerns.
And what are the new kinds of Westerns?
Well, it's intriguing to me if people say that the Western has died, and some people think it has. 1990 and 1992, we win Oscars for Dances with Wolves and The Unforgiven. And those are the first Westerns to win the Oscar since the 1930s with Cimarron. So in a two-year period, two Westerns win the Oscar, which suggests that the Western has come back.
Let me push you a little bit on that. Tell me what films, as of, let's say, in the last two decades, you have found particularly interesting and that maybe blazed new trails.
There are both personal favorites and ones I think are important for people to understand as images for American culture. I think Dances with Wolves, which I don't consider a great film, but it's where Americans were in their sympathies toward Native Americans, so it was quite reflective. The whites are raving idiots, but the Native Americans are heroes in that film. In 1992, with Clint Eastwood in The Unforgiven, what you have is what I call the new gray hero. The same man wears a white hat and a black hat. And Gene Hackman in that same film represents that new gray kind of hero. Let me suggest a couple of others. 1993, Geronimo, I thought was a wonderful film because what it did, through a young white man trying to understand the two cultures, the culture from his own background and the culture of Geronimo. And what you have is the figure of Geronimo, very much reflecting the culture of Native American. It's a complex film. It's not one-sided. I think Dances with Wolves was a much more one-sided film. And then the middle 1990s, maybe my favorite, is Lone Star. Lone Star is a modern Western set on the border of Texas and Mexico. And it's full of images of ethnicity and race and of gender and of environment. And it's an excellent film. So it's a contemporary West, but it deals with the subjects that are uppermost in our mind, and it's astoundingly well done.
Now, you seem to want to expand the Western beyond the common image of the cowboy and the gunslinger to include films that envelop the West, but What about the West makes it so unique so that you can call a film like Lone Star a Western film?
There's no question that I tried to do 19th and 20th century. I even go as far as to say that Thelma and Louise is a Western. Most people disagree with me, but here are two women going out into the modern West trying to find their identity, and somewhat like the 19th century male figure in so many other Westerns. It's the open landscape, the fluidity of society, and the difficulty of dealing with violence. Those are main themes in the Western. That could be either 19th or 20th century.
So you're really building on the idea of an opportunity, a place where people can test themselves, where they can create a new identity, where they can deal with the environment to become different than they would have been if they'd stayed back in the more, quote-unquote, civilized East.
No question that that's still an idea in people's minds. Remember the closing of Huckleberry Finn? Lighten out for the territory ahead. The West, so often, in film, has been that lighten out for the territory ahead.
And none of us want the widow or their aunts to civilize us, so we head out on the river.
It's still a masculine genre, by and large.
Great. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Dick. Very interesting. You've been listening to Dick Edelain, co-editor of The Hollywood West, and this is Talking History.
We just heard Richard Edelain explain the magic of the West on film. No more magical figure exists in Western lore than the outlaw Jesse James. Not surprisingly, two of James' homes, both in Missouri, have been preserved as historic sites. Here to tell you about them is Joey Skidmore.
While he was robbing Midwesterners of their gold, jewelry, and other valuables, Jesse James also stole America's heart. Maybe it was the outlaw's flamboyant and bold tactics that captured the imagination of adventure-loving Americans. Or it could have been the news media, which portrayed James as a 19th-century Robin Hood, robbing from the rich and giving to the poor. If you're interested in learning more about this glamorized American bandit, visit the Jesse James Farm in Kearney, Missouri, and the Jesse James Home Museum in nearby St. Joseph, Missouri. James was born and raised at the Kearney farmstead. The site also contains his original grave. He spent his adult life and was killed in the St. Joseph House, which now serves as a museum dealing with his life and death. Among the items on display are artifacts from the grave, including the coffin handles, a small tie pin James was wearing the day he was killed, a bullet removed from his right lung, and a casting of his skull, showing the bullet hole behind his right ear.
Thank you, Joey, and while you're in St. Joseph, Missouri, be sure to drop by the Patti House Museum, only a block away from the James House. Originally built as a hotel in 1858, the Patti House has since served as a hotel three times, a women's college twice, and as a shirt factory. In 1860, it served briefly as the headquarters for the Pony Express. Pony Express operators Russell, Majors, and Waddell had their main office there, and riders stayed at the Patti House as well. During the Civil War, the Union Army took over the building. Patti, who backed the Confederacy, decided to sell the building in a nationwide lottery. But when 100 tickets came back unsold, Patti bought them himself and won back his own hotel. Finally, we turn to our commentary of the week by Eric Rauchway, professor of history at the University of California, Davis. Rauchway compares President George Bush's crusade against business corruption to that of President Theodore Roosevelt.
President Bush has promised to restore confidence in American capitalism by putting more cops on the Wall Street beat. Journalists have already likened Mr. Bush's plan to Theodore Roosevelt's Republican crusade against business corruption, which also began with a promise to catch corporate criminals. But Roosevelt quickly found out that playing cops and robbers didn't stop what he called crimes of cunning in the business world, and he began to campaign for systemic reform. If Mr. Bush wants to be a Republican reformer too, he must take a similar step toward stronger government regulation. In the late 19th century, corporate accounting fraud sapped public confidence in the market. Companies routinely overstated capital investment by issuing shares representing a bigger equity stake than they actually had. They called the practice stock watering, after an old rancher's trick. Unscrupulous cowboys would salt the cattle feed before taking a herd to market, so the livestock would drink lots of water right before being weighed for sale. Afterwards, they'd do what cows do with extra body water. and what watered corporations do with investors' dollars, sending them down the drain. Attacking stock watering as a grave evil, Roosevelt called for criminal sanctions and open accounting standards, depending on publicity itself to stop bad behavior. It didn't work for him, and it won't work for Mr. Bush either. Listening to the president today, you would think nothing had changed in a century. Just like Roosevelt, Mr. Bush promised increased police presence and more publicity. Greater transparency will expose bad companies, he tells us. But nowadays, just as in Roosevelt's time, the problem with the market is not with Mr. Bush's few wrongdoers who have failed the system. The problem is the system, which encourages modern versions of stock watering by prizing short-term share price gains over long-term earnings. Roosevelt eventually recognized this and helped to create and sustain the vision of a free market made stable and profitable by government oversight. Theodore Roosevelt's cousin Franklin institutionalized this vision in cooperation with a Congress that created the Securities and Exchange Commission and the Glass-Steagall Banking Act. But just like the 1920s generation of self-seekers, whom FDR blamed for chasing a boom market instead of keeping corporations responsible, we have stood by while our representatives gutted New Deal regulations or let them lapse. We have lost sight of the Roosevelt's vision, and as FDR warned, without vision, the people perish. If Mr. Bush wants to win re-election like the Roosevelts, he'll have to succeed where his father failed and master the vision thing. He cannot just borrow the Roosevelts' rhetoric, but must back stricter regulation because he believes it is right.
You've been listening to Eric Rauchway, author of The Refuge of Affections, Family in American Reform Politics, 1900 to 1920. Rauchway's commentary, adapted by the author from his longer article in the Financial Times, comes to us courtesy of the History News Network. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, University of Missouri, Kansas City, Kansas City, Missouri, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Information about the OAH and Talking History is available at oah.org. Until next time, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.